I'm Gabe Ortiz, afternoon host at WIPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make the live streams like this one more difficult to maintain. Stand up for public media and help fortify WIPR's future. Find out more and donate at WIPR.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it's Midday on Higher Education. My guest will be Mark Ginsburg. He's the president of Towson University. So how is Towson dealing with budget cuts or pressure to cut DEI initiatives or restrictions on international students and the growing prevalence of AI in academia? So we'll talk about all that with Mark Ginsburg, the president of Towson University, tomorrow here on Midday. My next guest today is John Carlos, a civil rights icon whose silent protest at the Mexico City Summer Olympics in 1968 has endured as one of the most dramatic and transformative moments in the history of the civil rights movement. John Carlos and Tommy Smith stood on the medal podium after winning bronze and gold medals in the 200-meter dash, fists raised in stocking feet, heads bowed as the American national anthem was played. Here's Howard Cosell of ABC Sports reporting from Mexico City on October 22, 1968.
I'm standing in the center of the Olympic Village here in Mexico City. To the rear, building number 11, is the American building. And with the track and field events of this, the 19th Olympiad, over, things have apparently simmered down. But I use the word apparently advisedly because they have simmered down only to the naked eye. The feeling, and there is great rejoicing here among the U.S. Olympic Committee officials, the feeling is that the Americans have done so very well, and they talk about all the gold medals the Americans have won, and they like to make believe that what happened during the past week never happened really. They like to believe that the black athlete once and for all has backed down. I can tell you he has not backed down. I can tell you that Tommy Smith and John Carlos, although the weight of American public opinion is against them, have not changed one bit.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos were expelled from the Olympic Village after their silent protest, and when they returned to the United States, they did face not only intense criticism but even death threats. After a brief career in the NFL, Tommy Smith earned a master's degree in sociology. He taught and coached track at the college level and continued his advocacy for civil rights. John Carlos had a brief career in the Canadian Football League, and he worked as a counselor in the California public school system for about 20 years. He's also been a vocal and passionate advocate for civil rights, founding the Olympic Project for Human Rights. And he'll be in Baltimore this weekend to receive an award from the American Visionary Art Museum. And I am delighted to welcome him to Midday today. John Carlos joins us on Zoom from Atlanta. Dr. Carlos, welcome to the show.
It's a truly it's an honor for me to be here.
Well, an honor for me as well. When you think back to your 20s, you were 23 years old in 1968 at the Olympics, when you and Tommy Smith devised that protest. Has your record, you've now, you're 80, is that right? Do I have your age correct?
Yes, correct.
How are you thinking about it any differently than you did when you were 40 or when you were 50? I wonder if you're thinking about what you accomplished and what the kind of attention it garnered has evolved or changed at all over the years.
It's almost like excuse me, it's almost like deja vu all over again. Everything seemed like it's come full circle. For me, as a youngster, from a very early age, if I felt something was broke, I felt it's adults' responsibility to fix it. If I don't see the adults moving, then it's my responsibility to fix it. So I would get up and try and make things right by any means necessary.
The iconic photographs of you and Tommy Smith standing on the medal platform, the podium, your hands are raised. You've called it in your autobiography a human rights salute. But of course, it was received as a sign of the Black Power movement at the time. Can you walk us back to that time? You have won your medals. Tommy won the gold. You won the bronze in the 200 meters. You didn't have a whole lot of time to figure out an elaborate protest, but you did spend some time thinking about what you might do. Can you walk us through how those discussions between you and Tommy Smith?
Well, in actuality, I had a lifetime to prepare for it. You know, prior to the games, it was a question as to whether we were going to boycott as a unified group of people. Individuals felt like, man, I promised my church, my kids are looking for me to win a medal, my community is looking for me to win. And we didn't have the right, when I say we, meaning the guys at San Jose State that formulated the Olympic Project for Human Rights, we didn't have the right to tell them that you must stay home from the games. All we could do is lay all the cards on the table, let them evaluate, make their decision. They chose to go to the games. John Collins was disenchanted about their decision, and I started to stay home. But, you know, I have this communication spiritually with the Creator, and he says to me, he says, John, you can stay home. But the question is, when they go to the victory stand, whether the person that fills your slot is going to represent you the way you feel you need to be represented. From that point, I decided that I'm going to make this team. When I went there and we started our process of elimination in terms of the rounds, the heats. I think when we got to the quarter semi, I approached Mr. Smith and told him that I was disenchanted about the fact that the boycott was called off. I wanted to make a statement. What is your take? He agreed that a statement needed to be made. Then I said to him, I said, well, what artifacts do you have to bring to the table? He had the gloves. I had the beads. He had the scarf. I had the black sweater. We were both wearing black socks. All of the athletes, black athletes, pretty much was wearing black socks. We decided that we would go out there barefoot to illustrate certain points. Going barefoot was to illustrate the poverty in which blacks and people of color had to endure at that particular time. The lynching, the beads that I had on my neck illustrated the lynchings that had taken place prior to my life, during my life, and hence my life is still going on today. Then the black sweater, I covered up my USA uniform primarily because I was ashamed of America. I felt America could be so much better. It could have done so much better in terms of having equality and a level playing field for all individuals. So I covered up my USA jersey. Mr. Smith had a black scarf on his neck to illustrate black pride. We were proud to be representing America, but we felt that America has never shown its pride in us representing them. So this is all culminated to make this particular demonstration powerful, because not only did we face the ills of society here in the United States, but there were other people in other parts of the world that was facing the same things and maybe had to endure even worse. But they never had a blueprint in terms of how to build within themselves the character, the fortitude, the strength, and the paradigm to have a better day. And I think we was that lighthouse for them.
John Carlos is my guest. He is the founder of the Olympic Project for Human Rights. He and Tommy Smith raised their hands in protest at the 1968 Olympics and were immediately thrust upon the international stage. Do you remember much about when you walked off that podium that night? What the initial immediate reaction was? What was the reaction in the stands? And when did you start hearing about the reaction around the world? How quickly did those reactions make it to you and Mr. Smith?
Yes, the way I frame that is, we went out there, it was blue sky, bright sun, and by the time we left the stand, it was thunder, lightning, dark. It was just a bad situation, from joy to anger. You know, relative to, you know, what happened here in the United States, once people caught up and realized what was going on in terms of the Olympic Games, it was split down the line, pretty much like it is in this country today. A lot of people of color and those other individual ethnic groups that were sympathetic to our cause, they were supporting us. But then there was the other side of the road as well, which was very negative. You know, I received a lot of notices from black military people that pretty much felt like I embarrassed them and set them back. And, you know, these are things that you have to endure, because when individuals come and confront you with a statement like that, you know, there's room for growth. There's room to learn. And those individuals had to learn the necessity of that demonstration.
The year 1968 was such a tumultuous year around the world, and certainly in the United States. Dr. King had been assassinated, of course, and the Fair Housing Act was passed that same year. I mean, there were some positive things and many negative things. Bobby Kennedy was killed just a couple of months after Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis. Some people have drawn some parallels to this age, the 2024, the 2025 period of American history, and the political bifurcation. The Vietnam War was raging in 1968. There was great division in the country about that. How do you see it? Do you think there are parallels between a very troubled time back in 1968 in our country and now, the present moment?
Yes, I believe I alluded to that when we first just started this discussion here. Yes, they're very much the same, very parallel to one another in terms of what's happening in society today. Our government here might be even a little more out of the box, you might say, than any governments that we've had in modern time. So it's really bad. You know, let's go back to you saying me raising the fist at the Olympic Games. When I raised my fist and Mr. Smith raised his fist, all hell broke loose. Like, we had lined up people in the street and just shot them down. And now I see the president of the United States running around and he puts up the fist, the power sign. I've never seen the media challenge him on one day. The right-wing media, the left-wing media, any media challenge him in terms of express to us, what does this fist mean that you keep putting up? Now, they equated my fist with black power. My fist was basically to say, hey, we're coming together, unification. We're for humanity. But they never got a chance to confront the president, or chose not to confront the president about what does his fist mean.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point that we do see from the president. A raised fist at any number of occasions. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back. I'm sorry, did you have another quick point you wanted to make?
Oh, no, I just said absolutely. I was agreeing with you.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break, and then when we'll come back, we'll talk a little bit more, and we'll talk in particular about the Olympic Project for Human Rights that you have been so active with over the years. John Carlos is my guest. He's an athlete and activist who did come to an international attention when he and his Olympic teammate Tommy Smith raised their fist to protest black oppression in the 1968 Olympics. Quick break, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. When we come back, if you'd like to join our conversation with the iconic civil rights activist John Carlos, when we return. It's Midday, I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is John Carlos. He is 80 years old, and as a 23-year-old sprinter, he won a bronze medal at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. At the awards ceremony following that event, he and his fellow American runner Tommy Smith stood on the medal podium and raised their fists in a gesture of protest for civil rights. That silent protest shaped their subsequent lives as activists, and it has endured as one of the most powerful moments in the history of the Olympics and in the history of the civil rights movement itself. John Carlos will be in Baltimore this weekend to receive a Lifetime Grand Visionary Award from the American Visionary Art Museum. And he joins us today on Midday from Atlanta. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So, Dr. Carlos, and you've been granted, I don't know how many honorary doctorates over the years, so I'm proud to call you Dr. Carlos. Tell us about the Olympic Project for Human Rights. What is the mission of that organization, and how did you come to become involved?
Well, I guess you could say my ideals and my philosophy has been the same in terms of challenging the system to be a better system for all people. I was going to school at East Texas State University. I see they had a young group of athletes there at San Jose State that was doing marvelous things on the athletic field. And one day I went to the mailbox and I picked up a track and field news, and I saw that it was far greater than just athletics in itself. These individuals were talking about things that concern humanity. It was concerned about the environment. They were concerned about, you know, prejudice and bias. And that caught my interest because those are the same things that I'd been concerned about from the time I was a teenager, a child, you might say. So I left East Texas State and I matriculated down to San Jose State. I had an opportunity to meet Professor Edwards maybe a year or two prior to my going there. I got a chance to meet a lot of the guys in the program. It's almost like you might say those guys was the bang, but I was the wick that brought the fire to the bang, like the missing component. So when I got to San Jose State, I guess I was a little more progressive, aggressive, coming out of New York. And I just felt it was a good fit to get together with Dr. Edwards and Dr. Ken Noel and the various athletes and formulate this Olympic Project for Human Rights.
And you've been active with it ever since.
Well, it's a part of me. You know, I'll tell you a little thing that happened to me when I was a kid. When I was like 7 or 8 years old, the Creator gave me a vision. In this vision, I saw myself on a, looked like a milk crate on a grass field. I could not see the people, but I could hear the people yippee-ki-yay, like just having a good time. And I realized that I'm the only one on this box, and with the excitement of the people, you know, as a little kid, you kind of excited about the fact that you could make adults happy. And I remember going to raise my hand to wave. You know, you want to get up on your toes because you want everyone to see you. And just as I went to raise my hand, it froze in time, pretty much like that. And people asked, why did it freeze? What happened? And what happened was the energy that the people had with the joy and happiness turned to anger and venom, spitting, name calling, throwing things, telling me where to go, the whole nine. And for a little kid, for that to happen, that's kind of stress. And by the time we went to dinner that evening, I was still in a state of stress in regards to that. And my father said to me, he said, Johnny, what's the matter? I said, Daddy, I was in a movie. He said, you were in a movie? What happened? Because you could see I was stressed about it. And I told him, I said, everybody was happy about something I did, Daddy. And then they got mad and they started throwing things at me and spitting at me and calling me names. And my father brought me into his rib cage. And he said, son, no one's going to bother you. My job is to protect you, love you, feed you, house you, and see that you get a good education. Nobody's going to bother you. And then he leaned over my head and he said to my mother, he said, Vi, it looks like God's got something special for this individual. We're going to have to wait and see. And I've always said, I don't remember what day that was, but I've always said in 15 years, I was on that victory stand. And I would think it was probably the same day because the exact same thing that happened in that vision happened in real time in 1968, October 16th.
Yeah, you did raise your hand then, that's for sure. Absolutely.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. Oh, what an amazing story. Let's go to the phones. Jesse is on the line from West Baltimore. Welcome to the program with the great John Carlos.
Yes, good afternoon, Tom. And thank you for having Mr. Carlos, Dr. Carlos on. I just wanted to say that he and Mr. Smith have always been heroes to me. I was a track 100-meter, 200-meter runner. And I remember in 1982, some 14 years after their Olympics that I wanted to raise my fist on the podium because of them. But my quick question or comment was, Tom and Dr. Carlos, there was a third gentleman on the stand by the name of Peter Norman. And I just wanted to get Dr. Carlos's quick thought, because I read that him and Mr. Smith ended up being pallbearers in Mr. Norman's funeral, because he's now deceased, but that Mr. Norman knew ahead of time, I read, that that they were going to raise their fists, and that he, I think, had a ribbon or something in support of them. So just wanted to get his thought about Peter Norman during that incident, too. That time.
Yeah, thank you for that call. Peter Norman from Australia. Yeah, tell us about him.
Yeah, let me start by saying Peter Norman is a brother from another mother. I mean, if I had to put my life on the line for him, I would do it today. As quick as I'd have done it that day. Peter didn't have to take part in that particular demonstration. A lot of people say, well, he didn't raise his fist. I offered Peter a button. He was actually reaching for mine, and he wore that button. Why did he wear the button? Because he had an understanding as to what racism and bias and prejudice is all about, because he experienced what was taking place in Australia. At that particular time, Australia and South Africa, they were running parallel with their attitude towards people of color. The Aboriginal people might have been the black people of Australia. Peter saw what was happening to them. He couldn't do anything in that moment, but he felt he could do everything in the moment in 68 in terms of expressing his concern, his feelings for it. So he stood with us on the victory stand. Mind you, I said he didn't have to do that. He chose to do that. Now, there's a lot of speculation about Peter was the one that had the gloves. Peter was Peter's idea. No, Peter didn't have anything to do with the demonstration until he asked me, he said, what are you guys getting ready to do? And then I expressed to him what was going on. And he said, yeah, I'm interested. I would love to wear one of the buttons. And I had to ask one of the rowers from Harvard University that had a button to pass me his button down so I could pin that button on Peter. And we went out there. So I'll always have love, admiration, and respect for Peter and his family as well.
And in our last couple of minutes, Dr. Carlos, what's your advice for athletes in this generation who have a platform because of their athletic ability? I mean, you have people like LeBron James, a fantastic basketball player, one of the greatest in history, not too many years ago, or 7 or 8 years ago. Fox News host named Laura Ingraham said publicly that LeBron James should shut up and dribble in reaction to some comments that LeBron James made when it came to social justice. What's your advice to Mr. James and to other prominent athletes when it comes to using their platform for social change?
Well, my advice to them would be, first and foremost, would be to study any situation they find themselves in. If you're going to make a statement, a public statement, make sure that you research, study, and have a full understanding as to what you are stepping up for. Because the media, they will challenge you on what you say, how you act, what you do. So study. And at the same time, realize that the money that you're getting is great money, but you can't buy freedom with money.
Yeah.
You understand? An individual might say, I could pay my way out, but we're not talking about that one individual. No one is free.
Great.
If anyone is in hostage.
And Dr. Carlos, that's all the time we have. I very much appreciate your time. Congratulations on your award that you're going to receive this weekend. Thank you for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
The athlete and activist, John Carlos. I'm Tom Hall. You've been listening to Midday. Thanks. Have a great day.